Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll look into the return of the militias with Mark Potok, who's the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project. He's the author of this new report that the Southern Poverty Law Center has just released, The Return of the Militias, which documents how, after vanishing for nearly 10 years, the anti-government militia movement is surging across the country, fueled by fears of a black president, the changing demographics of the country, and fringe conspiracy theories increasingly spread by mainstream media figures and political figures. And then we will look into a government option that does work in spite of the propaganda to the contrary, the VA, the Veterans Health Administration. We'll be joined by Philip Longman, the author of a new book, Best Care Anywhere, Why VA Healthcare is Better Than Yours. And then we'll be joined by the author of The Road to Nowhere, The Genesis of President Clinton's Plan for Health Security. We'll look into the Clinton's attempt at healthcare reform and why it failed and what lessons Obama can learn with Dr. Jacob Hacker, who is a professor of political science at Yale University and a resident fellow at the Institution for Social and Policy Studies. He's also the author most recently of Health at Risk, America's Ailing Healthcare System and How to Heal It. Let's now begin with the subject of the return of the militias here in the United States. I'm speaking with Mark Potok, who's the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and the editor of his award-winning quarterly investigative journal, Intelligence Report. Mr. Potok leads one of the most highly regarded operations monitoring the extreme right in the world today. In addition to editing the magazine and the Hate Watch blog, Potok acts as the key spokesman for the Southern Poverty Law Center's a well-known civil rights organization based in Alabama. And he testifies before the Senate, the United Nations High Commission on Human Rights, and other venues. The Southern Poverty Law Center has just released a new report, The Return of the Militias, which documents how, after vanishing for nearly 10 years, the anti-government militia movement is surging across the country, fueled by fears of a black president, the changing demographics in the country, and fringe conspiracy theorists increasingly spread by mainstream media figures. And Mark Potok, preceding your recent report on the rise of the militias, the Homeland Security did do a report on pretty much the same subject, which was met by a great deal of resistance, both in the Republican Party and on the Hill, and more importantly, in media venues like Fox News. Are they changing their tune?
Well, not really. I mean, what has happened is this. As you say, the DHS report, which was done in April, was leaked. It was met by immediate attacks from the American Legion, the likes of Rush Limbaugh, and truth be told, most of the Republican Party, who characterized it as an attack on all conservatives. Their claim was that, you know, this essentially made every conservative or every person opposed to high levels of immigration or abortion, into a potential Timothy McVeigh. It was very much a tempest in a teacup. If one actually read the report, it was, certainly in my opinion, it was spot on. It was a sober, reasonable assessment of what was going on out there. Wasn't talking so much about militias as hate groups, groups that are explicitly based on racial hatred, but it was right. Nevertheless, despite some remarkable events afterwards and the aftermath, including the murder of the Museum of the Holocaust, of a guard at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, and the assassination of an abortion physician, the Department of Homeland Security essentially backed off the report. Secretary Napolitano more or less repudiated it, said it had been done badly, and so on. And in my view, purely as a matter of buckling to pressure from the right. In any event, yes, the DHS report was similar. They have noticed, and we've seen a number of other law enforcement reports and have interviewed many officials around the country who see the very same thing, a rise of these groups, as you said in the introduction, as a reaction to Obama, to non-white immigration, and to some extent, which is hard to measure, the kind of crumbling economy.
And we've had also apparently, since President Obama has become president, an enormous uptick in the purchasing of weapons and ammunition. And I understand that the police officers that were killed in Philadelphia were killed by a white supremacist who believed that Obama was going to take his guns away. So how much is this anecdotal, or is does this look or indicate an alarming trend?
Well, two things. One, we have had in the last 6 or 7 months since Obama's election a really remarkable rash of domestic terrorism. In fact, there have been 6 law enforcement officers, including the 3 murdered in Pittsburgh that you mentioned, the security guard, and another 2 sheriff's deputies in Okaloosa County, Florida, again, murdered by a man or allegedly murdered by a man who the sheriff describes as having been trying to join a militia just before the murders. So, you know, that is certainly going on. We haven't seen anything like it, going back to the late 90s when we had a very high level of domestic terrorism or attempted domestic terrorism from the radical right. So, you know, that is going on. At the same time, we're seeing a more broad-based anger, essentially from rural whites in this country, and certainly I don't mean to characterize all rural whites that way at all, but, you know, it's an anger I think you see reflected in the town hall meetings. It's not where what you see is not merely a debate about health care and what might be the best option to ensure the rest of us, but people talking about death panels and pulling the plug on grandma and that sort of thing. And this also, as you mentioned in the introduction, very much aided and abetted by mainstream figures, most famously in that case, Sarah Palin. But, you know, that's not much different than, Lou Dobbs going on CNN and talking about, Obama not being a citizen and needing to show his birth certificate and so on. There's just a real anger out there, and I think that it is very much directed at the government. And, of course, the head of the government, the face of the government today, is a black one. So it is mixing race into this in really a kind of volatile and scary mix.
But is what is going on here, Mark Potok, without getting into amateur psychiatrics, it seems pretty clear that the people who hate Obama, or who Obama makes incredibly uncomfortable, are motivated largely by race. However, these mainstream media figures like Lou Dobbs, Limbaugh, and political figures like Sarah Palin seem to be essentially giving those people permission to hate Obama, not because he's a black man, which is politically incorrect, but because he's not a legitimate American citizen, because he wants to pull the plug on grandma, and because he wants to have death panels where her Down syndrome baby would be judged for its worthiness to continue its life. And I mean, this stuff is insane, but it is being propagated out there by credible people. And it seems to me that that's what I find particularly disturbing about it, is that it is, in effect, because they really don't have a case against Obama, they're literally making stuff up in order to give people permission to hate him.
It's just absolutely poisonous. And, you know, in addition to the people we've mentioned, you know, there are a number of leading politicians, in addition to Sarah Palin, who are, you know, very much feeding the frenzy. So, you know, when you get a congresswoman like Michelle Bachmann from Minnesota saying that Obama is setting up political re-education camps into which all of our children are going to be forced, you know, it all feeds the same idea. You're right, you can't attack in sort of mainstream America Obama because he is a black man. You certainly can call him a socialist, although, I'd say there's not a scrap of evidence to support that actually being true. But in any event, that's the song that is being sung. He's a socialist. He's a servant of the New World Order. He represents the elites who are really out to do in regular working Americans, the people, you know, who really make the country go, who live in the heartland and so on. So, you know, in those ways, it's very, very similar. All the ideas being circulated most broadly are very similar to the ideas that really animate militias and the so-called patriot movement. You know, we're all being, our country is going to be subsumed into a new world order. We'll all be part of some massive one-world government. And, you know, this is the fear that has been expressed, really, going all the way back to the beginning of the 20th century, this idea of somehow being forced into, some sort of global fascist order.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Potok, who's the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project. And the Southern Poverty Law Center have just released a new report, The Return of the Militias, which Mark has been the editor of. And this report indicates a movement that sprung up more or less at the end of the Cold War, as if there's something in our political DNA in this country that we need an enemy. Once the Soviet enemy went away, suddenly a fictitious enemy within the country, black helicopters, UN soldiers, all of that mythology, which then culminated, or at least it manifested itself in the Oklahoma bombing, which was an act of homegrown terrorism. However, Mark, it's worth going back to that incident, and I know that you did a lot of work on it. Initially, the Oklahoma City bombing was attributed to Arabs, and particularly some Jordanians, and a so-called terrorist expert on television, Steve Emerson, was naming names of Arabs and Jordanians and all this stuff. And at the end of the day, it was, I think, quite disturbing to a lot of people that it was a homegrown terrorist incident. I've been talking to a lot of the country's top anti-terrorism specialists, and almost unanimously, they believe that the next terrorist attack in the United States will not come from foreign jihadis, but will come from domestic homegrown terrorists like Timothy McVeigh.
I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, I as a matter of fact, I covered Oklahoma City as a reporter for USA Today at the time. And I'll never forget that initial reaction. It's got to be Arabs. It's got to be Muslims. A story that many people don't remember is, as I remember, two or three days after the bombing and just before Timothy McVeigh was captured, and it became obvious to the entire world that this had been the work of a domestic sort of red-blooded American. A woman, an Iranian woman in northern Oklahoma's house was surrounded by a furious mob who had been egged on by the likes of Steve Emerson to believe these were foreigners, you know, sort of wearing turbans on their heads who had come to do this to us. And that woman, who was 7 or 8 months pregnant, actually miscarried as people were throwing stones through her windows and so on. So, you know, all that to say, let's not leap to conclusions. I mean, in many, many ways, this movement is just as dangerous as the jihadi movement abroad. You know, to say one other thing, back in 1998, a plot that came out of the radical right in Texas contemplated that what they were attempting to do was blow up a natural gas refinery next to an elementary school. It would have killed all those kids in the elementary school. Their absolutely amazing idea was that this attack would draw all police and emergency personnel to one side of the county so these guys could go and rob banks on the other side to fund the Aryan Revolution. You know, when those people were taken down, and they were because the leader got cold feet about murdering all those children at the last minute and went to the FBI, the federal authorities said as many as 30,000 people would have died in that explosion. So, you know, that's the level of danger we're really looking at.
And in your report, Mark Potok, the Southern Poverty Law Center's a new report, The Return of the Militias. How does the audience access that report?
It's on our website. It's both on the front page at www.splcenter.org, where you can read it in a Word document or download it as a PDF.
And in this report, I'm puzzled as to the kind of mental gymnastics that go on here within this movement in order to justify arming themselves and training. And you ask yourself, well, what training for what? I mean, the Second Amendment says the state shall have well-regulated militias. These are completely unregulated. And what do they think they are doing out there with guns in the woods with camouflage?
Well, they're very much, as that fellow said at the New Hampshire town hall, they very much believe that the reason the populace should be armed is because government will always turn into an enemy ultimately, and it's their duty to beat it back as good patriots. Now, you know, accompanying this is an amazing growth of conspiracy theories. So it's not merely that the government is too big or is spending too much money or has too much of a role in the lives of its citizens. It's that they have a secret string of concentration camps. You know, it's that they are planning to send each and every one of our children to political re-education camp. You know, it's that the government is going to decide whether your family members live or die. So it reaches this level of kind of white-hot fury, and of course this is, you know, more prevalent in the interior and even more so in the West, where there's a real history of feeling that the government is, messing in people's lives and it ought to get its nose out of them. So, you know, it's quite extraordinary, but, very much within the American tradition. You know, it's interesting to note that the Europeans, who very much have their own radical right, but a neo-Nazi radical right, look at these people as truly lunatics. I mean, they cannot understand or process this information. And, you know, I would argue that the nature of our own radical right has a lot to do with the nature of how this country began, right, which was essentially in rebellion against a monarchy, sort of telling King George to, you know, get his nose out of our business and so on.
Right, but
so there's a long tradition of this.
Sure, but King George is long dead, and the British have left.
I've noticed that.
Well, but I'm saying these people out there with guns training in the woods to fight what? They're going to be fighting and killing Americans. There's no other way to pass it. That is the part of this that I find extraordinary. And then you mentioned the fellow who was at the town hall meeting that Obama had in New Hampshire. He was wearing a loaded sidearm, and he was holding up a sign that says the Tree of Liberty needs to be refreshed. Now, the full quote from Thomas Jefferson is, "The Tree of Liberty needs to be refreshed from time to time with the blood of tyrants and patriots." Now, there's no question what this fellow was, who this fellow thought was the tyrant. That's Barack Obama. And who he thought was the patriot, that's himself. And at the risk of repeating myself, at what point do the people like Limbaugh and Sarah Palin and others who are fanning these delusions and fueling this paranoia, at what point do they take responsibility for the actions of people like that guy that's had a loaded firearm at a presidential event? And anybody knows anything about American history knows that there's a sorry record of presidents being assassinated.
Well, sad to say, I mean, it appears that at no point at all do they take responsibility for what they say. You know, we have not heard Lou Dobbs take back his claim that, you know, Obama was not born in this country, or at least his demand that Obama show his real birth certificate. We have not heard Michelle Bachmann withdraw her claim that there are secret political re-education camps, or Spencer Baucus, another congressman, withdraw his allegation that there are 17 secret socialists in the U.S. Congress, rather evocative of memories of Joseph McCarthy. And on and on and on. I mean, there are scores, if not hundreds, of people in the quote-unquote mainstream who are out there on cable television, on public, talk radio, you know, talking about all of these theories. And, you know, it may be that they are mere panderers, that these are people who will do anything to get ratings. But from my own point of view, it's quite irrelevant why they do it, whether, as Glenn Beck says on Fox News, I'm merely a rodeo clown, doing an entertainment show, or whether they really mean it. Because the reality is, as you've suggested, there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Americans who listen to these people, see them as authority figures, and actually believe what they hear. So, you know, I don't know what can be done. Well, I mean, I do have an idea what can be done. I mean, I think Lou Dobbs in particular, who we've had kind of a long-running battle with over the years over these kind of false allegations, very much got called out in the last few weeks over the birther business. You know, what we haven't seen is a full court press against the people who make just these ludicrous claims about death panels and concentration camps and all the rest of it.
Well, there was a case in Tennessee where a heavily armed, delusional guy shot up a school. And when the police went to his apartment, they found books by Beck and Hannity and O'Reilly almost exclusively in his bookcase. Now,
that's right, and his idea was he needed to kill liberals. He had gotten the idea that, quote-unquote, liberals are the people who are destroying this country. And that's essentially what all those books, the Ann Coulter books and the O'Reilly books and so on, at his home set.
I remember at the time O'Reilly and others huffed and puffed and said, how dare you connect us to this? This was the act of a lunatic and et cetera. So they're not willing to take responsibility. So my question is Rupert Murdoch willing to take responsibility if somebody takes a shot at the president or does something hideous like these militias are planning, blowing up and killing 30,000 American citizens? At what point do the people who enable this poison to be put out over the airwaves, public airwaves, by the way, at what point do they take responsibility?
You know, all I can tell you is, for instance, there is right now a very serious campaign directed at CNN's President Jonathan Klein, who initially started out telling Lou Dobbs in a private memo, an internal memo that was then leaked, as he said in the memo, this story is over, referring to the birther conspiracy. In other words, all the allegations had been aired, flatly shown to be wrong, and so on. When that memo was leaked and when a lot of criticism of Dobbs was made public, including our own call for CNN to fire Dobbs, Klein went very much in the opposite direction, saying Lou Dobbs was a terrific journalist, that he stood behind him 100%, and so on. So there just seems to be a sort of epic moment in refusing to take responsibility. I mean, I think if somebody is shot or a building is blown up, the likelihood of an O'Reilly or a Jonathan Klein, for that matter, or any of these people to accept any responsibility is remote. I just don't think they're going to do it. They're putting their heads down and insisting that, you know, this is merely, protected by the First Amendment and so on, which it certainly is. But, you know, there's a kind of ethical responsibility. If you are a journalist, you don't tell false stories to the people, to your reading or listening audience, particularly the kinds of falsehoods that these people specialize, the kinds of falsehoods that have the effect of demonizing entire groups of people, whether they be brown-skinned immigrants or federal law enforcement agents or representatives of our federal government.
Or the President of the United States.
That's right.
I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Mark Potok.
And thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking there with Mark Potok, who's the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project. He was the editor of the Southern Poverty Law Center's just-released new report, The Return of the Militias. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. And I'm speaking with Philip Longman, who is a senior research fellow and research director of the New America Foundation's Next Social Contract Initiative. He's the author of numerous articles and books on demographics, economics, finance, and healthcare, and social change. His work has appeared in such publications as the Financial Times, the New York Times Magazine, the Wall Street Journal, Washington Monthly, and the Washington Post. He was formerly a senior writer and deputy assisting managing editor at U.S. News and World Report, and he's won numerous awards for his business and financial writing, including UCLA's Gerald Loeb Award and the top prize for investigative journalism from investigative reporters and editors. His latest book is entitled The Next Progressive Era, A Blueprint for Broad Prosperity, and his previous book, which we're discussing now, is Best Care Anywhere, Why VA Healthcare is Better Than Yours. And Philip Longman, that's certainly going to come as a surprise to a lot of people, that VA healthcare is better for yours. You have to admit that there's been a absolutely long and persistent drumbeat of propaganda suggesting that the VA is dysfunctional, dangerous, and produces the worst outcomes.
Well, that's right, Ian, and no one was more surprised than myself to find out what the VA has been up to recent years. I came into this several years ago when Fortune magazine called me up with a story idea, and the idea was for me to go out and find out for them whoever it was who was the Jack Welch of healthcare, Jack Welch being the fabled CEO of General Electric in the late 1990s. And I thought that was kind of an intriguing subject, and I was also quite personally motivated because I had not long before lost my wife to breast cancer and had seen enough of the American healthcare system to know that I very much would like to find out who the Jack Welch of healthcare might be. But when I went out to start reporting on this story and talking to experts and reading the emerging literature on quality in healthcare, I kept getting back this answer I couldn't believe, which was that on just basically every conceivable metric you can think of, including cost effectiveness, patient satisfaction, observance of protocols of evidence-based medicine, that VA was coming out on top in study after study. And so that caused a lot of smoke to go off in my head because that was pretty much contrary to everything I thought I knew about healthcare and the world in general. But it turns out to be true that this gigantic federal bureaucracy with a history of scandal going back to the 1920s has turned itself around and has an awful lot to teach us about how to get health care right.
Well, it doesn't seem to have stopped, though, Philip Longman. It hasn't stopped. I just saw the other night on television a Republican congressman saying, you know, that the public option that President Obama is putting forth in his health care proposal, look at the VA. Who wants their family treated like they are treated at the VA? Now, that may reflect the fact that probably at the end of the day, not one Republican will vote for this health care reform, whatever form it takes. And you also have to look at what just was said over the weekend by Senator Grassley, who's a key figure in the negotiations of the Senate Finance Committee. He told the audience in Iowa that he has put his finger in the dike to slow it down in order for the town hall meetings to take place in this recess so that people could get riled up and shut it down. For some reason or other, President Obama still thinks Grassley's in the mix. So do you have any explanation for why people are allowed to get away with these bald-faced lies?
Well, at least when it comes to the VA, part of what's at work here is that fewer and fewer people, including many conservatives, actually have any contact with the military. If you're in the military or know people who are in the military, you know darn well that the VA is a great system. You know that the American Legion has bent all its efforts to letting people use their Medicare to get VA care. The closer you get to military life, the stronger the image of the VA. And that's reflected in the customer satisfaction numbers that are better for the VA than for fee-for-service Medicare or anywhere else. You know, unfortunately, a lot of people, you know, last time they heard anything about the VA, it was back in the 70s and had to saw a film with Tom Cruise in it, and that's where they get their image, and there's nothing to contradict it. There was an unfortunate scandal at Walter Reed Army Military Medical Center 2 years ago, which is a hospital run by a separate cabinet agency, the Department of Defense. But a lot of people, that distinction was lost on them because they know very little about the military or how our government works in general. So, yes, the VA does have a lingering image problem, but people who know the military, people who know healthcare quality, set it up over and over again. And it helps to understand this, even though it's so counterintuitive. But part of what's at work here is that the VA, so uniquely among American healthcare providers, has a lifelong relationship with its patients. So it starts when they get out of the military and extends up to nursing home care many times. And that means as an institution, it actually has an incentive, a business case, for keeping people well. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't control diabetes well, for example, doesn't manage the disease, it's on the hook down the line for the amputation, blindness, renal failures, and all the rest that comes down or comes with diabetes. This is something that's actually lacking elsewhere in the healthcare system because basically we pay people to perform procedures. Even idealistic people within the healthcare system outside of the VA come to realize that investing in something like a smoking cessation program won't return any investment because by the time the prevented heart attacks don't happen. The patient has long since moved on to some other health care plan. So this is part of why the VA, which is a highly integrated system with a lifelong relationship with its patients, is at the forefront. The other thing that they have done is they are pioneers in the use of electronic medical records, which, you know, they were doing as early as the 1970s using what we would today call an open source code development process. And they've just taken it to a whole new level, so that not only does it become a tremendous tool for preventing medical errors, but the outcome data that is collected through these digital records allows researchers to go back after the fact and look and see what processes and procedures and pills actually work and which don't, which is one of the reasons, for example, the VA was very early to pick up on the dangers of Vioxx, you know, a drug that killed more Americans than died in the Vietnam War. They could just see out of these clusters of heart attacks who had what all those folks had in common, and it was Vioxx. So it's really a different, a whole different model of care that integrates electronic devices with a true evidence-based model of care. And as I say, it's extremely cost-effective. Its cost per patient is about two-thirds that of Medicare for equivalent people. And most stunningly, its costs have not been going up. We've had, you know, double-digit inflation in healthcare generally, but in the VA, basically costs have been flat and at about two-thirds per patient what the rest of the healthcare system's doing. So it's a pretty inspiring story once you can get your head around it.
So what happened, Philip Longman, to turn the VA around? I know it was traditionally a dumping ground for political hacks, as unfortunately is the FAA. But so obviously something turned it around in the 70s?
Yeah, it's actually a very inspiring story. It was first a revolution from below and then a revolution from on top. The revolution from below started in the 1970s when things really were bad at the VA. And individual VA doctors and other healthcare professionals were just desperate to find some way to improve their working conditions. And it just so happened that about that time, the first personal computers were becoming available. You could go down to Radio Shack, and if you had a Phillips head screwdriver and a gearhead, you know, you could actually build a little kit. And a lot of these guys started doing that, and they started using these early PCs and mini computers to do things like create the first electronic medical record, which saved them enormous amounts of time and having to trace down different pieces of paper that should be in a patient's file but weren't. You know, these guys were up against it, so they sort of on their own and eventually against central office orders, you know, went about constructing this underground movement that brought health IT to the VA. Most of this happening in the late 70s to early 80s. Then in the early 90s came a revolution from above in the form of a man named Ken Kaiser, who was actually a Republican from California, had at the tender age of 30 run California's healthcare department, had a kind of public health mindset, and Bill Clinton appointed him to take over the VA's health operations in 94, at a time when many people were thinking that either the Clinton health care plan would displace the VA, or we would just give vouchers to all these veterans and be done with the VA. So it wasn't a very high-profile appointment, but it turned out Ken Kaiser was just an amazing change agent, and he was able to take the work of all these underground hard hat types who had constructed this VA IT system and actually use it to begin measuring various metrics of quality, keeping track of what was working, what wasn't, which surgical teams were performing, which ones weren't, how did the VA stack up on its screening for different devices or for different diseases, and just created a culture of accountability in the VA, did a lot of decentralization at the same time. And so coming into the late 90s, the VA all of a sudden starts showing up in peer-reviewed studies of quality in healthcare is having these highest metrics. And that's what I sort of first picked up on. And then when I started visiting the VA and talking to vets, and it all started to make sense to me. Part of what I think another advantage that they had is that the VA's population is an older, sicker population than the U.S. population as a whole, and has been for a while. So in the 1970s, they were treating a population that was very much like today's population in terms of how old it was, how many chronic diseases people were afflicted by, and they glommed on very early to the new reality that most of the disease load that are facing Americans is these multiple long-term chronic diseases that have to be managed very carefully. It requires a great deal of integration and coordination among various specialists involved in a disease like diabetes, for example. So VA got very practiced at that. It got very practiced at primary care and preventive care because it had an institutional incentive to do so. And basically emerged as the best care anywhere. Now, it did take a licking during the Bush administration. There were some, I don't think the VA is as good as it could be because of some things that happened in the Bush years, but it still is an outlier on quality despite all the hardships it's had.
Well, Shinseki, though, the new head, he's replaced a Bush appointee, right, who was a political hack, right?
Yeah, many of the Bush people came from the Department of Defense, which basically has a procurement culture. So if they need a hammer, they go out and find a defense contractor and pay $600 to have one made. Whereas the VA, because of this legacy of the 70s I was telling you about, had a very much a sort of do-it-yourself culture, a culture that we today call open source. And, people recognize in the world of computing that open source basically is the wave of the future. These guys were doing it without having a word for it. And I guess when you look back at it, it's not totally surprising that health IT that was written by doctors for doctors at the VA is much better than the proprietary stuff that's available to doctors. And soon, because of the stimulus bill, a lot of them are going to have to buy these proprietary systems that haven't had any success in the market so far. But the VA has, because it has this bottom-up culture, does its IT using doctors to write software for doctors, it has this very robust and IT system and the whole model of care that goes with it, and tremendous buy-in from all the healthcare professionals that are involved.
And it's apparently a lot of countries in the rest of the world that are borrowing what the VA has done in terms of this kind of healthcare reform in terms of technology. And, of course, it's worth remembering that we spend 16.5% of our GDP on health. The rest of the industrial world spends 10% with better outcomes. but we're not going to get into a debate about single payer here because that's the system that everybody else uses.
Right.
But the thing that's extraordinary is that this whole story has gone so much under the radar. Just in closing, Philip Longman, does Obama know that he has a very successful department headed up by General Shinseki?
Yes, I have reason to believe he does. And I also have reason to believe that when this current program probably crashes and burns or is so compromised that we're just left with something completely inadequate to the problem, that people will start to focus much more on the VA model. And it is not about insurance. We don't have an insurance crisis. We have a health care delivery crisis. We have a health care system that kills 98,000 people a year through medical errors alone, that's riven with all kinds of unscientific practice. If we can get the conversation on the delivery of health care, and do it in a way that we're not talking about some exotic system in Sweden or even Canada, but something that is all American, the VA, and that a lot of rather conservative-minded Americans know about through personal experience and know that it's good, then we can concentrate on a very specific plan. It would not be very difficult for us, for example, to take the VA software and protocols of care that have formed from its software and begin to go to the various St. Elsewhere's around the country, these little public and community hospitals that are going out of business right and left all over the place because of all the unreimbursed care, and basically say to them, look, if you will install the VA's Vista software, if you will adopt its protocols of care, we'll guarantee you a pool of patients who are newly mandated to have insurance. This will be the default system. We can roll that out from community to community. It's not ideological. It's we have a system. It works. We can quibble about why it works, but there's no question that it does. And I think that's the face of healthcare reform. You know, we've been talking about single payer for a long time or the individual mandate. The VA is beyond either one of those. It's single provider, right? And it turns out that that model is the best care anywhere. You know, and as I say, no one's more surprised than me or Fortune magazine to hear that.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Philip Longman.
Take care.
You too. Hello again, I'm Ian Master. Just speaking then with Philip Longman, who's a senior research fellow and research director of the New America Foundation's Next Social Contract Initiative. He's the author of numerous articles and books on demographics, economics, finance, healthcare, and social change. And he's won a number of awards as a journalist, having been the deputy assistant managing editor of U.S. News and World Report. He won the UCLA Gerald Loeb Award and the top prizes for investigative journalism from the Investigative Reporters and Editors. And he has written this book, Best Care Anywhere, Why VA Healthcare is Better Than Yours. I'm now speaking with Jacob Hacker, who is the Stanley B. Resor Professor of Political Science at Yale University and a resident fellow at the Institute for Social and Political Studies. He is also a fellow at the New America Foundation in Washington, D.C., and he's the author of a book, The Road to Nowhere, The Genesis of President Clinton's Plan for Health Security, that we're going to be talking about here. But most recently, he's also written Health at Risk, America's Ailing Health System and How to Heal It. Before we get into the good news, Dr. Jacob Hacker, let's go back to President Clinton and his wife's attempt at healthcare reform and look into why it failed and what lessons Obama can learn. The first question I would have is, there seems to be some analogies here in as much as President Obama seems to be having problems from his own side, from the Democratic side, with the Blue Dogs. And President Clinton was hardly supported when he came into town by the Democratic Mandarins on the Hill. After all, people forget that in 1992, the Democrats controlled all three branches, the House, the Senate, and the White House. And it was the perception that they got nothing done in those 2 years that led to the blowout in 94 that brought in Newt Gingrich and the Republican control of the Congress.
Absolutely right. Yeah, no, it's, and I keep thinking of that Yogi Berra quote. It's deja vu all over again. It feels like a lot of the same problems that President Clinton faced back in 1994 have resurfaced, and that's not surprising. You know, President Obama was elected with a larger margin and with I think a much stronger mandate for change. But there continue to be fissures within the Democratic Party, and this is just a really difficult issue. There's a lot of reason to think that the chances for reform are better than they were back in '93. But as we're seeing, that doesn't mean it's going to be easy.
And Dr. Hacker, do you see a sense of self-preservation within the Democrats, because if the Blue Dogs are responsible for health care going down, I mean, I think it's reasonable to assume that President Obama will not get one Republican vote in spite of his efforts at bipartisanship. It'll be exactly like the stimulus package. There'll be zero Republican votes, and to some extent, that's already been telegraphed by the senator from Iowa said, who's a key negotiator on the finance committee, right. just the other day, he said that he's keeping his finger in the dike in order to delay it long enough so that we can get out to the town hall meetings and all you people can shout it down.
Yeah, that was not the most encouraging statement to get from someone who's supposed to be a a bipartisan deal maker on this issue. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it is important to distinguish between the House and the Senate. The House is a highly majoritarian institution. When 50% plus one want to do something, they can, and the leadership, the Democratic leadership in the House, can really get what it wants on this issue if it can get its ranks together. And despite the Blue Dogs' concerns, I think that there is a good reason to think that there will be a strong bill passed out of the House. It's really the Senate where the difficult political lift is for President Obama.
So you think there's enough sense of self-preservation on the part of the Blue Dogs that they will recognize that if we, the Democrats, sabotage this and end up with nothing, we're going to get punished in 2010?
I think that's part of the thinking. I mean, I also think it's worth remembering that although there are conservative Democrats in the House, that their numbers are much smaller than they were when President Clinton tried and failed to reform health care. In 1993-94, and remember, we didn't actually get to the point where Congress was debating this until 1994, there wasn't even a bill reported out of committee, and the crucial committee that stalemated was the House Energy and Commerce Committee, which is where the Blue Dogs this time around staged their intervention, if you will. But as it is, there has been a bill that was agreed to by enough of the Blue Dogs to get it out of the Energy and Commerce Committee, and now there are three committees, the three crucial committees that in the House that have acted. So I think that it's self-preservation. It's also that this is not as conservative a group of Democrats as it was back in 93-94. And also, this issue is really important to the Democratic Party. And, you know, there were a lot of lessons taken out of the failure of the Clinton plan, but certainly one of them that no one could miss is that the party is going to be punished for failure to act on this issue, even if Americans are worried about what they're up to. So, you know, right now I think there's a lot of public unease that's been fostered by the criticisms of the plan, and you might think, well, now perhaps the Democrats won't suffer if they don't do something. But the fact is that the ineffectual nature of the Democratic majority in 93-94 was a really crucial precondition for Newt Gingrich's getting Republicans to regain take Congress for the first time in 40 years. And I think that the Republicans will fare much better in the midterm elections if the health care reform effort fails this time around as well.
So do you expect some pushback from the White House and from the Democrats supporting health care reform to reverse this trend, which has got a lot of people alarmed to the point where a lot of people think that this thing is either going to go down in flames or end up so compromised it'll be worthless?
I think there's a great deal of push from the White House and Democrats, as well as, and this is a big difference from 1993-94, as well as from industry groups that back in 93-94 were opposed to reform, notably the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry. Both are running ads in favor of reform in general, if not in favor of the specific reform plan that the House House committees have backed. So that's going to help, but I think that there's a real risk that this will fall through, and I think there's also a parallel risk that it will be so watered down by the time it gets through the Senate that there isn't going to be a widespread recognition that this is a big step forward by many Americans. So I think those are both risks. For the Democrats, obviously, not doing anything is much more risky than doing something half-heartedly. In fact, in the House legislation, many of the key provisions don't go into effect until 2013, so after the next presidential election. So a lot of the big promises that are being made, and I think there are a lot of the very attractive features of the legislation are not actually going to take effect not only before the next midterm election in 2010, but before the next presidential election. So to me, the really crucial question right now is whether the president can seize control of this discussion and whether Democrats, I think, really can get their act together, particularly on the Senate side, because it's there that I think there's a real danger that a really bad piece of legislation will get produced, and Democrats at that point will be so eager to embrace anything rather than have the whole thing go down in defeat, that they'll embrace whatever gets produced there. So I think it's really important now that the Democrats realize that their political survival and the future of this issue hinge on their really working to regain control of the debate. It's not easy, but I think there is prospects for doing it if they really seize the moment now.
And Dr. Jackie Hackett, clearly the Democrats in the Senate are missing Teddy Kennedy. I mean, he's talk about an irony. This is a man whose entire political career has been devoted to getting health care through, and the very moment when he's most needed to do the heavy lifting, he's incapacitated.
That's right. And I don't think it's really interesting because no one would have thought that Ted Kennedy would be a decisive vote. He's, after all, a very liberal member of the Senate, and he was certain to vote for any reasonably good health care reform package. But it's turned out he's much, much more important than people expected. You know, Chris Dodd of Connecticut, was not able to play the brokering role in the committee, the health committee, the Health, Education, Labor, and Pension Committee, that Kennedy would have. And that, I think, made for a more acrimonious and confrontational process that I think probably alienated both some moderate Democrats and some Republicans. But even more important is that I think every vote is going to count if, as expected, this is done through the normal Senate legislative process, and it can be subject to a filibuster, because you need to have 60 votes, of course, to overcome a filibuster. And so suddenly Senator Kennedy's vote matters. So you have two senators, Robert Byrd of West Virginia and Kennedy, whose ability to vote on final legislation is subject to doubt, and therefore you might need to get at least a couple of Republicans and probably more to get this passed. But I don't think you're going to see much Republican support in the Senate. If this passes, it's going to pass with a fairly unified Democratic group and a handful of Republicans that cross over.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Jacob Hacker, who is a professor of political science at Yale University and a resident fellow at the Institute for Social and Political Studies. And he's the author of The Road to Nowhere, The Genesis of President Clinton's Plan for Health Security. Of course, we're looking at the failure of the Clinton plan and what lessons Obama can learn. And, of course, more recently, Dr. Jacob Hacker has written Health at Risk, America's Ailing Health System, and How to Heal It. Tell me about the role of Betsy McCoy in both back in scuttling the Clinton plan and the attempts that she's made to do the same with the Obama plan.
Yes, another aspect of this debate that reminds me of that deja vu all over again quote. Yeah, so Betsy McCoy wrote a widely publicized piece in the New Republic back during the debate over the Clinton health plan, and she claimed at the time that the Clinton health plan would lead to rationing and denials of access to private care. She said things that were patently untrue about the bill, that all of which were designed to really scare people into thinking that what President Clinton wanted to do was to herd people into large, tightly managed health maintenance organizations and prevent them from seeking care outside those organizations or from using their own dollars to buy the latest in medicine. And it's exactly that set of concerns that have surfaced again. And lo and behold, it is Betsy McCoy who went from being a think tank denizen during the Clinton health plan to lieutenant governor and really propelled herself into the political class with that original article in the New Republic. And now, of course, she's claiming similar kinds of things about the legislation that just has been passed out of the three committees in the House and the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pension Committee in the Senate. You know, again, there is two features of these claims that I think are worth that have come up both times around, and they've come up in every major debate about health care in the United States. One is a really strong emphasis on the fear of government intervention in care. You know, and so that's why I think President Obama is spending so much time saying this, you know, I don't want government bureaucrats to mess with your care, but I also don't want private insurance bureaucrats messing with your care. There is nothing in this legislation that would allow the federal government to, you know, make life or death decisions or intervene directly in the delivery of care in any way that should be worrisome to Americans. And You know, it's a little strange, but, you know, people right now are saying, you know, we've got to keep government out of this and make sure they're not touching my Medicare. And Medicare, of course, is a government program. So this is a very strange discussion. And the second feature of this critique, so it's focusing a lot on fear of government, is this very constant talk about rationing of care and about denials of care, because I think most Americans are very fearful of the idea that not just government, but anybody would be able to make such freighted decisions for them. And this is a very, very frequent set of assertions in debates over health care, and again, has little relationship to anything that's in this legislation.
Well, Dr. Hackett, just in the last minute here, you mentioned that the president will need to push back, and he's already started that, I guess, in the sense that he has an opinion piece in the Sunday New York Times, why we need health care reform. He says in this that we can save a lot of money by just reforming Medicare and Medicaid. It's obvious that if you eliminated the Bush Medicare Advantage, which was a direct giveaway to just a pure subsidy to insurance companies, and, of course, the prescription drug bill was a giveaway as well. It's even though Obama says that he wants to eliminate the, or make that reduce the amounts seniors pay for their prescription drugs, apparently he's made a deal with them, the pharmaceutical. So that's all a little unclear. There's also $150 billion you could save if you addressed obesity in this country, and $100 billion you could save if you addressed cigarettes. So there's a lot of savings. Where's the focus?
Well, that's the thing. I think it was, if you read the president's piece in the Times today, it seemed to me a bit diffuse. You know, it's trying to get people focused back on insurance market reforms, on the ability and need to save money so that people are not stuck with these ever-rising premiums. But, you know, there is a sense in which the president has had and his allies have had to move toward reassuring people, making them feel as if whatever they do isn't going to threaten what they have, rather than being able to make this positive case for what they want to do. And that's what concerns me. So the next step really is to move beyond offering reassurance and really, really drive home why this is so crucial. And I think the president has done that insofar as he's said, if we don't act, you know, we're going to face more and more problems. And most Americans believe that. I mean, there are...
Well, I thank you for joining us. I'm afraid we're running out of time. This is a discussion we'll continue to have. Obviously, this time to pursue this. And I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles today, Dr. Jacob Hacker.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot. And again, Dr. Jacob Hacker is a professor of political science at Yale University and the author of The Road to Nowhere, The Genesis of President Clinton's Plan on Healthcare. I'd like to thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, Elliot Vaughn, the associate producer, Anthony Castillo, the assistant producer, and Teddy Robertson, the engineer.